Folks, welcome back to Bad Quaker Podcast. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. I was honored to have Scott Horton on the show with me, and Scott and I were on the phone. We had a really good conversation. It went on a little longer than our normal podcast, and we do have physical restraints as to how big of a file that we can load up on the website. So what I've done here is a little unusual. I've taken the interview that I did with Scott Horton, and I've divided it in half, and so here's the first half of the interview, and Monday we will play the second half of the interview with some bonus material from a different phone call that I was on as well, and there will be a little tease for that at the end of this show. So have fun, listen to Scott Horton and I talking about war and peace and all that kind of stuff, and then at the end of this podcast I'll tell you what's coming up on Monday. Thanks a lot, folks. Welcome back again to the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is, well, actually, it's not Thursday. It's this podcast is for Friday, March 22nd, 2013, and it will be podcast number 287. I'm pre-recording it because with me on the phone is Scott Horton. Scott, welcome to the Bad Quaker Podcast.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
It's an honor for me to talk to you. You know, I've followed your work for so many years, and you've done so much for truth. But you know, you're really known for peace. But in fighting for peace, you're fighting for the truth, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I really appreciate that. It's great to hear.
So your show is located. We can get to it in two different ways, from scotthorton.org. Or you're also on the No Agenda Radio. That's right. The Freedom Fiends, for some of my listeners, the crossover audience, the Freedom Fiends were over there at No Agenda Radio for a while. But Scott Horton can be found over there every weekday except Thursday. And that's why I'm able to record him today on Thursday. Scott, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you know, I always thought if I ever got to talk to you, I'd want to hear your version of why it is that we are involved in all these wars. It just seems like, well, it doesn't seem like, it's a fact that they're never ending. They have no intention of ever stopping them. They're going to continue to push us into more and more wars until somebody does something about it. But what do you think the motivation behind all this is?
I think ultimately it's just as really applies to any government program. It's simply a matter of economics and built-in incentives. It's a government program, and so therefore, like all government programs, it's a filthy, dirty, in this case, bloody snowball rolling downhill, and you just can't stop it. It's amazing. Christopher Coyne did this study recently at George Mason University, where he attempts to grapple with the distortion in our economy since World War II in the creation of the military-industrial complex and its political power, you know, to keep itself in business, and just how far the America we live in now is from what it would be without this military-industrial complex. I mean, if you think of the housing bubble of the last decade as this massive distortion, well, think of the distortion of our entire economy in all of our manufacturing being centered around making weapons of warfare for the last, what, going on 70 years now. It's completely out of control. But what it means is that, Nick Turse wrote this book called The Complex, and he says, you know, there's too many dashes. You can't sit here and say the military, industrial, congressional, scientific, educational, every other thing in the world, every other part of our economy complex. It's just the complex. And it includes Hollywood, of course, and it includes, well, virtually everything. If you're in the toothpaste business, you need that Army contract. Are you crazy? You're going to let Aquafresh run off with all the Pentagon toothpaste money? There's no way. So no matter what it is that you do, it's in some way distorted, or you know, on any major level of industry anyway, it's distorted by the military economy, and it becomes just in too many different people's interests to keep things the way they are. And I don't want to save them for last because they're least, because they think they really are the most important thing involved in all of this. And this is really Gareth Porter's thesis. It's the generals themselves. They are just obsessed with ribbons and decorations on their pretty little uniforms and in getting ahead and just getting that one step further on and at any cost. And when their job is killing people and or occupying the world, then that's what they'll do, kill people and occupy the world. If it means one more stripe, one more bar, one more little ribbon to brag about and one more rank up the ladder back at headquarters. So when you have, for example, some bases in Kyrgyzstan that no one can remember what the excuse was when they put them there in the first place anymore, and somebody somewhere says, well, maybe political competition inside the Pentagon says, maybe we should close down that base in Kyrgyzstan. Whoever's running that base in Kyrgyzstan is going to come up with a brand new reason we need to keep it. Why, in fact, I heard that there was a truck full of heroin drove by here the other day, and that maybe we could be useful in interdicting heroin around here. What do you think, boss? And they'll find a way to just keep the thing going. So it's really no different than housing and urban development or, health education and welfare or Congress or any other part of the government. They will find an excuse to be needed. You know, they'll find a reason to be. In fact, one more thing here real quick. There was an article in DefenseNews.com where they said, you know, since the big drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan, which the one in Afghanistan is really only just beginning, the drawdown there, we have this entire part of the Army looking for ways to stay globally engaged. And so they formed the Dagger Brigade, and they're headed to Africa. They're looking for work. They're what H.L. Mencken called job holders, right? They're just bureaucrats, and they're looking for something to do. And so if they can't kill Iraqis anymore, well, there's a whole dark continent. Let's get started.
Holy crap. It just makes you want to just rub your face, you know, in unbelief that people actually live like that. But they do. That the way you describe the generals is, from an economics point of view, what they've done is they've created for themselves a niche in the market, and they have the ability to continue to create it. It's regulatory capture. It's stuff I talk about all the time on the show, that they and self-selection bias, my other favorite economic rule, that just pushes the worst of those people to the top and causes them to be able to capture parts of government that gives them more and more power to just continue their business.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just finished reading this book, The Passion of Bradley Manning by Chase Madar, and it's really great. And he talks about how, you know, you could go through all the hundreds of thousands of State Department cables, and nowhere will you stumble across the national interest being pursued. It's just not there. It has nothing to do with any of it. Everything that the State Department does anywhere around the world is mostly about a gun to their head, some kind of combination of carrot and stick, that you're going to do what the state wants or what the state's favorite corporation wants in this particular interest. That's it. And you wouldn't even find a State Department flunky reporting back to Foggy Bottom confused and thinking that there's a national interest at stake in any of these places. That's not what any of it is about. It's all about, you know, you could look at it all through the lens of that public choice theory or whatever, where it's all about the individual interests of the people making the decisions and involved in it and the people that they're representing. So if the AEI puts out a think tank study saying this is what needs to be done about Iran, you can bet that they're looking at their bottom line, and their bottom line is, how big of a contract are we going to get from Exxon and Lockheed for next year's budget to write more propaganda just like this?
And this is really nothing new. I mean, it went on, obviously, all through the 20th century. But I was, you know, I saw a thing this morning that said that that the U.S. is still paying veterans benefits to children somehow or another from the Civil War.
Yeah.
And from the, you know, the Spanish-American War. And money is still going out to individuals. Imagine, the U.S. is probably still paying corporations for ammunition or some stupid thing like that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that debt. I mean, name of the game, right, is never paying it off, but always paying interest on it. And almost all of that debt is war debt and armament debt. I mean, Ronald Reagan added $4 trillion worth of national debt in the 1980s, and that wasn't really for hot war, but it was for a massive nuclear missile buildup and that kind of thing. So same thing. I mean, that's where all that debt comes from. And, yeah, I mean, you look at the Iraq War, where it already cost $1 trillion. And where a few years back, Jesus, what, 7 years ago now or something, Joseph Stiglitz did some math on his fingers and said, this is going to cost $3 trillion. He wrote a book, The $3 Trillion War. And then he put out, with his co-author, an op-ed in the Washington Post immediately saying, our mistake, we should have said five. And now the recent headline from last week is six. But now let's, you know, blinders off. If we're still paying for Civil War veterans' kids. And you think about that, right? Like, they were a very young vet in the Civil War. They got someone pregnant in, like, the 1920s, and now that person is, well, like, 80 years old or whatever it is, you know? It just barely. Think about the cost of all the Iraq and Afghan war veterans' kids 100 years into the future, how many trillions of dollars we're talking about here. I mean, the U.S. will cease to exist before they can make good on all that.
Yeah, it will, actually. I mean, that's like an economic fact of life. This kind of spending kills not only empires. You know, even people get upset when you say America's not an empire. They say America's not an empire. Well, you know, people get upset about that, but the fact is the fact, whether you want to call it an empire or not. No country can spend this kind of money and be engaged in that many foreign wars and continue to exist.
Right. I mean, this is why all empires fall. In fact, I used to be a much bigger conspiracy theorist back 10, 12 years ago, and I just figured that the masters of the universe have got to understand as well as me that all empires fall. So therefore, the John Bircher guys must be right, that it is all, the whole empire is an inside job. It's all an attempt to destroy America the only way you can. You make it so top-heavy, it'll fall. But then I realized the explanation is a lot more simple. It's just that dirty snowball rolling downhill. This is why all empires fall. They end up being run by the Richard Pearls and the Barack Obamas of the world. These narrow-minded, short-sighted, self-interested thugs, basically. And then what do you think they're going to do with an all-powerful nation state? Be humble and prudent and reserved and restrained and pursue liberty? No, afraid not.
Not very likely. And since you mentioned Barack Obama, you know, we should also mention that just because there's a D beside his name means absolutely nothing. The Republicans, if they were in power, they'd be the same. When they were in power, they were the same.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of entertaining in a way. That's right-wing criticism of Barack Obama. And there is some truth to it in a way, if you look at his attitude on guns and stuff like that. But basically, this smear that he's a socialist, that he's a Muslim, that he's a Kenyan, that he's a Afro-sporting fist-in-the-air, black power, Black Panther radical from Chicago, you know, some kind of commie socialist with a name like that, maybe sent by Osama to come and undermine us on purpose, you know, as this conspiracy against us and whatever. When the truth of the matter is, the reason he's so horrible isn't because he's a black radical from Chicago. It's because he's a white conservative from Illinois. You know what I mean? Like, he's really no different than George W. Bush, who is no different than Clinton, who was no different than George Bush's father. I mean, and what are these people? Who are they? What do they represent? They're the center right. That's what they are, basically, with minor deviations between them. They are pro-welfare state, but pro-capitalist, not laissez-faire capitalism as you and I prefer it. you know, being libertarians, but they're certainly will go to extraordinary lengths to bail out their friends, the capitalists, you know, who already made all the money and serve their interests, and to wage this nationalist war. And, you know, Obama even invokes the same kind of American exceptionalism that says that sins become virtues when America commits them because of just how special we are and all that kind of thing. I mean, he really is much more, I mean, it's all just characterizations, but it seems to me a much more apt description is that he's a center-right, at least, you know, 50% white conservative nationalist imperialist.
Yeah, and you know, I talk quite a bit about how he droned three Americans, two of which were accused of using words that the federal government didn't like, and the third being a teenage kid that wasn't even accused of anything other than being the son of somebody else who used words that the government didn't like. But this is not all that unusual from what we've seen in the past. It's just that the technology has changed, and you know, maybe people are seeing it that didn't notice it before. But this was going on in the Clinton era. He was just using a different type of technology. He was using cruise missiles. And let me just, I don't mean to scatter around too much, but on an economics point of view, you know, the only real difference you were mentioning about whatever government program it is, war is just another wasteful government program, except with the one exception that with war, when they flip a switch, $50,000, $100,000, $500,000 just vanishes in an explosion. Whereas, you know, with something like housing or some other fat government program, it takes 30 or 40 years before they have to dynamite the buildings, you know, and tear them down and rebuild them. But I didn't mean to get scattered there and take on three topics at the same time.
No, well, hey, listen, no, that's an important point. It's just another government program in the sense that the exact same rules, economic rules, apply, and there's nothing special about it. And if you, that's really a point, like kind of trying to pick on the right a bit, right? Where, oh, yeah, we're also anti-government. The only part of the government we support is the world empire. You know, that's the basis of the entire police state and the national debt and everything else. Where, you know, because I don't know why, because of the green of the uniforms or something, the emotions tied to the national anthem or something like that somehow exempt the Pentagon and its employees from what conservatives at least claim to agree with libertarians about when it comes to the capitalist economics and the economics of state power. I don't mean to play down in any way the severity of the consequences and just how much worse. I mean, the Pentagon is every other government program to the nth power when it comes to just how much they destroy and the cruelty involved. I mean, and look at the suicide rate. Now, what does that represent? That's good men who've come home and can't stop thinking about what they did while working for this government, and they would rather be dead at their own hand than continue living knowing what it was that they did and unable to get rid of it. And that's not in every single case. Some of that is they saw their buddies die right next to them or whatever, but a lot of that was terrorizing people. I mean, waging a war, let's face it, the American government defeated the Iraqi government in 3 weeks back 10 years ago. The rest of that war was a so-called counterinsurgency against the civilian population of the country that was resisting. And so, you know, the tortures and the pain and the grief and the humiliation and the deprivation of the Iraqi people and of the American soldiers even who inflicted those tortures on them is absolutely immeasurable, right? I mean, if you were to try to stack it all up in bricks, it would be the size of the whole earth. And so, it makes domestic socialism look like they're doing you a favor.
Yeah, you know, a war has always taken a toll on the mind of the soldiers, and of course for obvious reasons. But I've made the argument before that, you know, whether we're talking wars back in history, World War I, World War II, even the Korean War to a certain extent, it was you were able to believe the lies of the government and believe that that what you were doing was justified and necessary. And, you know, whether it was or it wasn't, the lie was easier, it was more palatable. But then by the time we got to Vietnam, you know, we as far as in looking at it in history, not necessarily us personally, but by the time you get to Vietnam, the lie became much thinner and it was much harder to digest. And a lot of people had a lot of emotional and psychological problems with Vietnam. But where we're getting to now in society is that you really have to strain to believe the lies and stay in, obeying those commands and everything. And that's just I really sympathize for the mind that has to deal with that. There's no way I could deal with it.
Yeah, well, and then you can't quit, right? If you find yourself over there in Afghanistan and you realize, man, I haven't seen an Egyptian or a Saudi the entire time I've been here. I'm just killing Afghans. And they don't, you know, there's this thing, I was talking with Phil Giraldi the other day. He was reading Jake Tapper's book. Jake Tapper from ABC News wrote this massive book about these guys at this no-win outpost out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded on three sides by cliff walls and sniped at all day. And they ended up closing down anyway, and the whole thing was for naught, of course, out there in the middle of nowhere, where these guys barely even know they live in Afghanistan. You know, that's not what they call it. And they thought these Americans that they were shooting at least at first, they thought they were still the Russians.
You know? Wow.
And these are our enemies that we're over there fighting, because they're going to come and knock down our towers, huh? You know what I mean?
I was talking to my brother. He's a hardcore, you know, neocon, right to the last breath. But I was talking to my brother about this, and he said, "Well, we can't back out. We have to win." And I said, "What is win exactly? When the last 12-year-old Afghanistan boy, everybody else in the whole country is dead, and he's standing on a mud roof shaking his fist at the sky. The only way to win this war is to kill every single one right down to that last little 12-year-old boy. And you don't have the guts to do that. America doesn't have the will to do that. Nobody really wants to do that. But if you're going to kill that, if you're going to win this war, that's how you have to deal with these people." And I don't think, I first off don't think that's, you know, I wouldn't try to morally justify that. But the reality is, they're not going to, you know, in our sense, give up like the Nazi Germany's, like, you know, like that. There's not going to be an official end to this war. The only way to end it is to get out and leave them alone. And there's no dishonor in that. It's just a matter of we're the aggressors. The U.S. is the aggressor, not you and I, Scott, but the U.S. is the aggressor. And until the aggressor stops aggressing, there's going to be war. And it's really just that simple.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the dishonor is in staying this whole time. There's just nothing justifiable about it. And I think that you're absolutely right that the only way to win, quote-unquote, win the counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan would be to send in the Marine Corps. Well, I mean, you could go, crazy with the hydrogen bombs. But other than that, it would be send in the Marine Corps to just wax everybody. And when you're done with your genocide against the Pashtuns of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and you've killed every last one of them, then you can, you know, claim that you conquered that place. But other than that, like you said, the Americans aren't going to do that. There's nothing that could make them do that. The American people would actually stop them, I think, if it came to that. And so, therefore, what are they doing? They're trying to pacify a land the size of Texas, landlocked in the center of Asia, where we're dependent on the Iranians and the Pakistanis and the Russians to help us get our equipment there at the cost of uncounted zillions of dollars. And not only is it a land the size of Texas, but it's shaped like Colorado. It's all mountains. And it's fighting a bunch of people who like fighting. I mean, the Pashtun tribesmen, that's kind of their bag. Man, and they haven't lost in a long, long time. They've defeated the Russians. They've defeated the British. They defeated Genghis Khan and the Golden Horde. Well, I don't know, defeated, but eventually drove them out, you know? and Alexander the Great and his men too. And so you're right. Just call it off. That's the only solution to it, is to just call it off, because right now the policy is to install a coalition of the Hazaras, the Tajiks, and the Uzbeks, and the Northern Alliance guys that fought for the Soviet communists, and for Hamid Karzai, the heroin junkie. And these people have no legitimate authority whatsoever. And I don't just mean legitimate to me. I mean they have no grassroots support among the people propping them up. They only have Western firepower propping them up. And so when we leave, yeah, they're going to get it. But the only way to prevent that is to stay forever. And so that is not tenable either. And in fact, that's not the plan. The plan is to draw down to a few thousand guys, but then try to keep a few thousand guys behind, which I think is, you know, the height of irresponsibility. I don't think a few thousand guys is enough for them to protect themselves and each other. I think when you're down to that low number of troops, you just go ahead and call it quits and leave, because otherwise those guys could find themselves surrounded and beaten on those battlefields. That's happened before, you know?
Yeah. Scott, can you stick, I need to break and save this file and stick in a commercial. Can you stick with me on the in the next segment?
Whatever you say.
Okay. We'll be right back, folks, with Scott Horton and Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast.
From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quaker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost BadQuaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it will cost about $700 more. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to BadQuaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can also give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button, or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support BadQuaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks.
Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with us through the break, and I'm with Scott Horton, and we were talking about the Afghanistan war and war in general. Scott, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the lies and the layers and layers and layers of lies that actually got the U.S. into the wars. First off, since we're on Afghanistan, I've always kind of in my mind blamed the entire thing in Afghanistan on two things, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because you know way more about this than I do, but I've always thought, you know, there was this background desire to run a pipeline through Afghanistan, and that's existed since the 70s, and the CIA has been involved, you know, in trying to draw the Soviet Union into the 70s and stuff. I've read a bit about that. But also, I think, to me anyway, what I've believed to be the major reason why Afghanistan was the target of the U.S. long before 9/11 was their poppy harvest. Am I just totally tinfoil hat and living in a space camp believing this stuff?
Oh, no, I don't think so. You know, I think I actually have to plead ignorance on the heroin thing. I mean, I just assume you know, I don't know, from 1982 on or so. No, I don't know. I guess 87, 88 on. When I was a young kid, I think I first learned about CIA dope pushing. And I just always assumed that the biggest black markets and drugs in the world are controlled by America's intelligence agencies, one way or the other, or at least they're trying to get in on that action one way or the other. That's a lot of liquid cash. It's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, at least tens, I think hundreds of billions of dollars a year in black market money. So obviously powerful people want in on that, and there's a hell of a lot of that being grown and distributed to the world from that Golden Crescent there, as they call it, in Afghanistan. Now, as far as that being the motive for going there, you know, I think really that was the motive for them trying to work a deal with the Taliban in the first 9 months of 2001 before the September 11th attack. And, you know, as you may know, Mullah Omar had been trying to put a lot of pressure on Osama bin Laden to not attack the Americans. And bin Laden's attitude basically was, I'm going to do this before you can stop me and hope you don't get too mad kind of thing. And he had actually, when it comes to the pipeline, the Taliban were fixing to make the deal with UNICAL in, let me call it 1998. I could be wrong about that, Ben, but I think that's right. But then bin Laden talked him out of it. Bin Laden talked Mullah Omar out of it and convinced him to go with Brightus, the Argentine company, instead, because screw the Americans, right, kind of attitude. And so that was the, it might have been later than 98. That might have been 2000-something. Because this was the famous phrase from the book Forbidden Truth by the French intelligence analyst and the French journalist about all these dealings. And that was, look, we'll either bring you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And the thing is, I don't know, I've read some people say that they've settled that the policy now has to do with just keeping anyone else from making a pipeline through there. Because rather than taking a soda straw and stick it into the Caspian Basin and going due south, mostly due south through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the port of Karachi and out there, that now what they're trying to prevent is the pipeline from what's called the Friendship Pipeline that's supposed to go from Iran, I think unnecessarily, through Afghanistan into Pakistan and then into India. And this is something, like, the only reason to include the Afghans in it is just as part of the alliance. You know, just to make political friends, you know, cut them in on the action a little bit, just, you know, for stability's sake. And this seems to be what, you know, perhaps what part of the occupation is about now, that if we can't have our pipeline, because there's just no security, really, in Afghanistan, not for any American businessmen to build any pipeline down from north of Afghanistan, down, you know, from north to south through there, just forget it. It's never going to happen. But maybe we can prevent somebody else from building one. Down in the south, that would be going more, you know, cutting across the south of Afghanistan from west to east. But, you know, I think, and it's a very libertarian understanding of the way the world works, right, that there could be a deputy assistant secretary of state or defense or CIA mucky muck whose name we've never even heard of, who actually has a great interest in the future of oil or a lack thereof or heroin distribution or cutting someone else out of heroin distribution or whatever, who are pulling all kinds of strings and making sure that things stay the way they are, that we'll never even be able to see from the outside. I mean, I can't really know. I think it's, you know, always right to assume bad motives. I'm afraid that I'm not the best at discerning and deciphering them all and ranking them in order of importance. I think if I have to default back to a single overriding thing, I will go back to generals like having jobs and they like getting promotions. And once they have a war, they don't ever want to quit. They want to stay as long as they can. And ultimately, you know, this is the Wolfowitz doctrine, which they haven't really repudiated. You know, if you read Obama's national security strategy, it's not much different from Bush's from 2002, which was cloned again in 2006, which is that America's policy is to forbid the rise of any near-peer competitor. That, you know, Europe can be Europe, but only as long as they're in NATO and they're our allies. Now, they can be as powerful as they are, but that's it. But we'll never allow any regional combination of powers to be anywhere near powerful enough to even dream of having a war with us. We'll crush them first. We'll dominate everything so that no one even ever tries it. And that's basically the deal, full spectrum dominance. And so through those eyes, Central Asia is all still fair game. For that matter, you know, Russia is still fair game. The whole world belongs to us, and in hell or high water, we're going to take it. You know, at least from the Pentagon's point of view, they're going to have a base there. And then whichever other interests can get in on it from there, then they'll get in too, you know?
You mentioned Osama bin Laden, and I, you know, there's a thing that sticks in my mind, but I can't remember where I read it, and I can't remember what, how to reference to it, because it was so long ago. But it, and maybe, I don't think I just made it up. I don't, you know, my mind might be weak, but I don't think it's that bad. But it seems to me that not long after 9/11 happened, that the government of Afghanistan at that time, run by the Taliban, made some kind of appeal to the UN or something and said, you know, the U.S. hasn't even asked for an extradition of this guy. Why are they going to invade us? Is that, am I making that up in my head, or was that an actual thing that happened?
Oh, no, you're right. And it's worse and better than that. I mean, the Americans, George Bush gave them a chance rhetorically. He pretended to give them a chance. He said, turn him over. That's it. And they said, okay, first of all, let me give you a good footnote to back this up, because I don't have a whole bunch to drop throughout my whole little thing here, but Anand Gopal, I think, is the best. Anand Gopal, spelled just like it sounds, has written all about this. And the first thing they did was they said, well, we want to see some evidence. And if you give us some evidence that he really did it, then we will turn him over to any Arab country, or it might have even been any Muslim country, for trial, which would have included Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan or any American sock puppet. That was pretty broad, right? And then they dropped that, and they said, well, we'll give him over to the UN. And then they dropped the proof and said, actually, we don't need proof. How about we turn him over to the UN for trial? And the Americans just refused to accept yes for an answer. That was it. I mean, there were three or four or five different stages of attempted surrender by the Taliban, basically. We will give up bin Laden. Here, take him. And Bush said, what? Can't hear you. Not good enough. You know, we're on our way to Kabul now. And that was it. They wanted their war.
Switching gears over to Iraq and the excuses given there, as, you know, as emotional as that time was right after 9/11, you can almost see why people, you know, they wanted, the American people wanted blood, and they were angry, and so you can see why they would say, you know, go attack somebody, I don't care who, attack somebody, get blood for us for this deed that's been done. But Iraq was a different thing altogether. You know, there was a lot of the pundits on TV that were inferring that somehow head of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, yeah. There were pundits that were sort of leaning toward the idea that somehow he was involved in 9/11. But the Bush administration never officially said that. They just stomped their feet about weapons mass destruction and openly lied and used the excuse of the hype of the day to go in there, didn't they?
That's almost entirely true. Dick Cheney invoked the obvious, ridiculous lie that Mohammed Atta had traveled to Prague, to the Czech Republic, and had been seen there meeting with the head of Iraq's Mukhbarat. And if you go back and trace this all the way back, it's the Sunday Times of London, and it says right there, Israeli intelligence sources say they saw the whole thing, and they saw the Iraqis hand Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, a flask of anthrax. Oh, please. And this was completely and totally debunked by the CIA and the FBI. And in fact, what did I just read yesterday? Maybe go to Tiny Revolution. Anyway, it was a NBC story. They quote the CIA officer. His name is Rossini. People can Google search this. His name was Rossini. And he said he went to the Czech Republic. He saw the picture of the supposed Mohammed Atta there. And this was not Muhammad Atta. He knew in one instant this was not Muhammad Atta. Give me a break. And then he turned on TV, and there was Dick Cheney the next day after he reported back that this wasn't true directly to the Situation Room, where Dick Cheney had to have known. The next day, there's Dick Cheney on TV saying it's pretty well confirmed that Muhammad Atta met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague in Czechoslovakia. Dick Cheney called it. There's a clue he's lying. He's referring to a meeting in a country that doesn't even exist and hadn't even existed for 10 years at the time, right? And as Ry Dawson pointed out. And Rossini said that was the first time he ever threw anything at the TV for something that somebody said on the TV. Dick Cheney lying about that. Now, the rest of everything else that you said about it is right, though. George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Stephen Hadley, the deputy national security advisor, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz at the Defense Department. I don't believe any of these, of the highest deputies and the principals, George Tenet, CIA, none of them said that Saddam did 9/11, ever, and or had anything to do with it whatsoever. They would say, well, he has ties to al-Qaeda in very vague ways, but it was always built around, well, what he could do to us at some point. But then, you know, there was a colonel named Richard Gardner, lieutenant colonel, I think. Anyway, Gardner, but not like a gardener in your backyard with an I, Gardiner. Anyway, he pointed out that Bush used this wonderful tactic, the excluded middle. All through 2002, he would say, why do we have to attack Iraq? Because of September 11th. One, two, Mississippi. Three Mississippi. And then he would say, because that day we learned that from now on you have to start all the fights instead of waiting for anyone to ever hit you first. So, but what it sounded like he just said was that Saddam did it, right? But then, oh, plausible deniability. There's this giant pregnant pause where it's George Bush after all. He's prone to misspeaking. You're prone to working on trying to figure out what he was trying to say. And so you do the work. And it sounds like what he meant to say was Saddam did the attack. But, you know, in 2002, I would ask, and in early 2003, I would ask people all the time. I was a cab driver, especially at the time, and I would talk to people of all these ridiculous opinions, and I would say, if Saddam did it, then how come we're waiting a year and a half to attack him? I mean, the truth is, you're making that up yourself because you're trying to rationalize and justify why they're doing this. In fact, I just played a clip of myself on a show yesterday. It's me in October 2002 saying this is the first time that I can think of where they started a war, but they didn't even really have a fake excuse. I mean, they have their fake weapons of mass destruction excuse, but they don't have a Lusitania or a Gulf of Tonkin. They're basically taking September 11th from a year ago, and they're trying to stretch it and make it last for a whole extra casus belli, for a whole extra war that has nothing to do with it. And unbelievably, it's working. I mean, they announced, a couple of weeks after 9/11 at the latest, publicly, that regime change in Iraq is next on the list, right? William Sapphire wrote it in the New York Times. Bill Kristol put out his open letter from the Project for a New American Century. All the neocons hit the media with it. And, you know, before New Year's, they were already announcing, we are on our way to Iraq, regime change is the policy, and anything we have to tell you between now and then to get you on board for this, we will, and we will go to war, and you can't stop us, and so you might as well hop on the gravy train with us, hop on the bandwagon with us, because this thing is going to happen. And it was, you know, led from the very top. It was not even a consensus on the right. It was a consensus in the White House. And they led the rest of the country, and it was just the most openly announced conspiracy probably in the history of the world, right? I mean, it was just, you know, it was like H.G. Wells, right? The open conspiracy. Here's our plan. We're going to lie you into war. Ready? Yellow cake, aluminum tubes, ties to al-Qaeda. Are you afraid yet? Mushroom cloud.
Wow.
As bogus as that. If you weren't on board for it and cheerleading with it, then you were sitting here going, oh, my God, I can't believe this.
You know, what amazes me that we got all the way through the Bush years and now we're almost through Obama years.
I know.
We're almost through the Obama years, and we haven't used these excuses to openly attack North Korea yet. That I'm actually kind of shocked at that, because I fully expected excuses to be used. But I guess I guess having, you know, the scary, scary North Korea over there rattling a saber is always handy for them to have as a backup in case they ever need to do that.
So that's where we're going to cut it off for today. Scott and I began the discussion of Korea, of North Korea. So in this podcast, we talked about Afghanistan and Iraq. And we talked a little bit about 9/11 and some of the things that have happened in the last few years. In the next half of this podcast, we're going to talk, as you can tell, we're going to talk about North Korea. We're going to talk about all that went on in North Africa and kind of have some ideas about what the future might look like. And in addition to finishing the interview with Scott Horton, Monday, when you tune into the podcast, you're also going to have a real treat. Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute is going to join us. I was talking to Chris this week on the phone, and he was kind enough to allow me to record about 20 minutes of us talking. And he was under some pretty tight time restraints. So that'll be how we start the podcast on Monday, with my phone call with Chris Edwards, and then we're going to come right back into the rest of the interview with Scott Horton. So you're not going to want to miss Monday's podcast, because Scott and I really get into some good stuff. And Chris and I, Chris and I are going to be talking about things like, Chris is, he's the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute, and he's considered among the world's top experts in federal and state tax and budget issues. So we're going to have some fun talking about stuff like infrastructure and government wasteful spendings and things like that. So be sure and check back with badquaker.com on Monday. And it's going to be a sort of a doubleheader with both Chris Edwards and the completion of today's podcast with Scott Horton. And as always, thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.